What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael Pina of SB Nation. Michael, the hiatus drags on. We have no major developments at this point in terms of when the NBA season might be back on. But I did write a story over the weekend about what the financial hit could look like and what it could mean for next season if they're not able to get these playoffs back on schedule. So let me just run through the kind of grim forecast for you very quickly, all right? We're looking at now potentially more than $1 billion revenue hit if they can't get the season back on. And that's going to take into account the remaining regular season games that couldn't be played and all the gate revenue involved there. That's taking into account whatever money they would take in from the gate at the playoffs. Of course, there's other television-related revenues as well. That is a big-time number, you know, $1 billion plus. The league's average annual revenues right now are right around $8 to $9 billion. So it's a huge chunk of their business, right? In turn, by not having that money, next year's salary cap could kind of drop basically somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 to $10 to $15 million, depending on whether these playoffs take place or not. So again, all these teams as recently as January are planning for the salary cap to increase this year to next year. Now would be in a situation where the cap might actually decrease, and that could have a lot of ramifications. It could put some teams into the luxury tax who weren't expecting to be there. It could just dry up all the free agency spending power that teams might have. So this year's free agents might not be able to get as big of contracts. There could be a lot of ripple effects. Now, it is important to point out, in similar situations like lockout years, for example, there can be a negotiation between the league and the players to say, you know what, we're not going to drop the salary cap. We're just going to sort of leave it where it is to kind of just make things easier so that teams aren't kind of getting screwed in those manners that I was describing, and that the business can kind of continue forward. In this case, though, Michael, if they did agree to do that, if they said, hey, we're going to keep the salary cap as is, the owners would actually need to be paying more to the players in the short term because the salary cap would be sort of artificially increased, if that makes sense, under these negotiations. And so I'm curious, like, if you were an owner or you're starting to think about some of these dynamics in terms of the big-time financial hit, should the league be aiming for that? Should they try to keep the salary cap a little bit higher or at the same level rather than having it drop drastically next year? Like, is that just better for business? Does it make everybody's life easier? What would be your opinion if you were on one of these owner calls?
It's going to be really difficult because, I mean, I think it's definitely, to answer your question, better for everyone if somehow they were able to keep the cap as stable as possible. You know, these teams plan out years in advance for free agency, for trades, for their financial decision making. And so if you were to suddenly drop the salary cap dramatically in an unprecedented way, as you said, it would impact their luxury tax payments. It would impact, what players that they're able to keep, what players they would be looking to target. And it would just throw everything into kind of a haywire. I mean, just thinking ahead to 2021, the summer of 2021, when there's so many different stars entering free agency, if teams that have been planning years for open cap space to afford, you know, max level cap space to afford some of these guys, and suddenly they cannot, I just think it would be a major detriment to just the overall health of the league. You know, this league now thrives on free agency and player movement, and that's one of the more exciting, love it or leave it, that's one of the more exciting aspects of the NBA right now. And in terms of trade rumors and free agency rumors and just all of that. So if that's, you know, damaged in any way, I think it's not going to be good for business.
Right. You want the chaos to come in free agency from how many deals are getting signed so quickly and the huge numbers, and oh, everybody's so impressed. Oh, all these teams combined to spend $1 billion in 24 hours. That's the kind of chaos you want. The kind of chaos you don't want is teams thinking, oh, wait a minute, I had like $20 million to spend, but now I only have $12 million to spend, right? And so the kinds of players who I was anticipating being able to get I can no longer even bid for, right? Or you don't want players out there saying, oh, I have to only sign a one-year contract because no teams are out there with any money to spend on me, and now I have to go into free agency again the following year and hope that the financial picture rebounds. We all remember what happened with the salary cap spike in 2016, right? Where it allows Golden State to sign Kevin Durant, and it totally changes the entire framework of the league for basically the next 3 or 4 years, right? Everything could be pieced back to that moment. You could have a similar situation here where, in reverse, now a lot of teams don't have money to spend, so it changes their thinking. But yet, after the NBA clears this whole coronavirus thing, life gets back to normal, revenues are back to normal, there could actually be a huge spike the following year, right? So you could actually have kind of chaotic interference, for lack of a better term, in terms of a drop and then a spike in back-to-back summers, which again, I think is not good for the overall health and stability and fairness of the league in terms of which teams are able to succeed and have long-term plans and which ones aren't. So I do think, and this whole drop and then spike theory has been put forward by John Hollinger and Danny LaRue at The Athletic. They laid it out really well in a piece. I think everybody should go read that. I do think the league and the players really too should be motivated to try to smooth out that effect, don't you think?
100%. I do question, though, how motivated or how agreeable the owners will be in all of this, because as you said at the top, you know, they're the ones who have to kind of pay up front to make this happen and ensure that stability. During the last labor negotiations, when there were new media rights deals that were going to spike the cap dramatically, and there was talk of potentially artificially smoothing it, and that was a proposal put forth by the NBA, and the Players Association basically was like, we don't trust you. That was basically the message there. And so we saw that humongous spike, and we saw players get crazy money in the summer of 2016. And so I just wonder how many of the owners will think back to that. And, you know, I'm not saying that they're shooting themselves in the foot just to shoot themselves in the foot, but carrying the brunt of it forward when a lot of these owners, I would imagine, are seeing, you know, outside financial ramifications for their own personal portfolios and their own personal businesses. So I think there's a lot of moving parts here, and I'm not, you know, super optimistic that it'll just be a smooth negotiation.
No question about it. I mean, let's use a couple of examples. Mickey Arison with the Miami Heat, his primary business is Carnival Cruise Lines. At this point, cruise lines are not a thing, right? And we're not totally sure when they're going to be a thing again, or if they're going to be a thing again, right? So if you're in that spot, the idea of prepaying millions of dollars to your players in a smoothing scenario based on, you know, anticipated future revenue could be a tough sell. Tillman Fertitta is another great example. A lot of his money comes from casinos, right? I'm not sure if you guys have seen pictures of Las Vegas lately, but it is the biggest ghost town anywhere in the world. I mean, all the casinos are closed. There's no people on the strip. I mean, you could walk around and not see another person for 20 minutes, right? That's not good for casino business owners in any way. And I think that there's probably a reason why Tillman Fertitta has been so kind of vocal about having fans in the building and trying to keep things like normal and everything else, because those revenues are probably more important to him than the average NBA owner, right? So you're going to need buy-in from a lot of different types of business people to get a sort of a smoothing scenario going forward. But I think the real takeaway here is this is one major reason why Adam Silver is pushing so hard to have a playoffs, because any revenue you're generating from the playoffs is making the salary cap decline or those negotiations like easier to swallow, right? It's putting on the playoffs makes more money from the television side, and so therefore your deficit compared to expectations is lower. And so I think that's one reason why we should kind of be patient here as observers and say, okay, let's see if they can really solve the playoffs or salvage them in some way, because the carryover effect is not just about can they crown a champion or not. It's about what does the financial picture of the league look like for the next 2 or 3 seasons, right? So just something to kind of keep in mind. I know your brain was sort of going to similar territory this week, Michael, in a piece that you wrote for SB Nation, because you're digging into like, okay, well, who are these free agents who could hit the market this summer or maybe this fall, depending if they delay the postseason and therefore have to delay free agency. And I know you were trying to play matchmaker, right? You're trying to take certain sort of high-profile players and dump them onto teams. And, you know, I don't know, you know, you being you, you know, Michael being the pod, you know, he's probably trying to, you know, get a little reaction from people too, you know, just for his own gratification. But I want to run through my three favorite matchmaker scenarios that you came up with. And I want you to kind of break down why those players should fit with those teams. How's that sound?
Sure. That sounds great.
Fred VanVleet, New York Knicks. Boom. You're just trying to get roasted by all of Canada, aren't you? Walk me through it. How is the beloved son of Toronto, Mr. Nearly Finals MVP, according to Hubie Brown himself, Fred VanVleet, going to leave Toronto for the New York Knicks? How is that working out?
So I guess if you're Toronto right now, or I guess I should say if you're New York, the only way you're going to lure Fred VanVleet away from Toronto is with a lot of money, like a lot of a guaranteed deal that is just humongous. I'm not going to say, you know, they're going to give him the max, but it would have to be the caveat here is that it would have to be a humongous bag of cash to get him out of there, because the Raptors basically are in a situation where they feel like they can get Giannis Antetokounmpo. They're hopeful, they're optimistic. That's why they want as much cap flexibility as possible. They maxed out Pascal Siakam a year earlier than they had to. They have, you know, Kyle Lowry under contract for one more season and $30-something million. That's not so much a long-term concern, but if you were to pay and make a long-term commitment to Fred VanVleet, that just makes it a little trickier to get Giannis in the door. So if that's their mindset right now, I could see a possibility where, you know, Fred is promised, you know, he's already plays a ton of minutes for the Raptors, but he's promised basically to be the marquee free agent signing for the New York Knicks and an opportunity to turn around or be the beginning of a turnaround that is like 30 plus years in the making. So I can see why he would be attracted to it potentially. And, you know, if you're the Knicks, you have not had not counting Jeremy Lin, you have not had a quality point guard in 20 plus years. And not only that, but I feel like VanVleet is such a great culture setter. And, you know, what I mean by that is he's obviously a champion. He's got champion experience. He's played in humongous moments. He's hit huge shots. The Raptors would not have won the championship without him. But he's also one of the league's most, you know, preeminent grinders and someone who doesn't expect overnight success. And he sort of epitomizes everything that the Knicks should try and be as an organization instead of this continuous team building strategy that doubles as one long get rich quick scheme. So I just think it would make a lot of sense for the Knicks and make a lot of sense for Fred VanVleet potentially. I mean, I don't want to say that playing for the Knicks is a smart thing to do, but in the right role, I feel like it would not be the worst decision in the world, and he could get a lot of money out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for his bank account is what you're trying to say, Michael. I mean,
yes, exactly.
So cash out Fred VanVleet is sort of the game plan here. How good could a team be if Fred VanVleet is like their number one max level player, right? Like, how much does he move the needle from a wins-loss perspective for the Knicks? Because I guess, to me, I kind of see what you're saying from Toronto's side. I feel like they're going to identify him as a core piece, and if they had to trade one of the older big guys or let one of the older big guys go in free agency and try to keep VanVleet along with Siakam and have that sort of be the centerpieces of their pitch to Giannis, I could see them kind of playing it like that, right? But let's say, for the sake of argument, Toronto follows the script that you're describing. Is New York completely convinced that Fred's the guy who's going to help them like be an eighth seed, or is that too fantastical?
I think it just, you know, going from where we what we saw out of the New York Knicks this season without Fred VanVleet to what they would be next year with him, with a lot of the same players on board, I would imagine, or a majority of the same high-minute players still in the rotation. I do not see the 8 seed anywhere in the near future, but basically I posited this as a better case scenario than what I think the Knicks will try to do, which is, you know, trade for someone like Chris Paul, give up future assets, and then watch as Chris Paul just completely disintegrates and you have, you know, $80 million hanging over your head over the next 2 years or whatever Chris Paul's owed. So that's kind of, it's like Fred VanVleet is not the best case scenario for the Knicks, but he's just so far from what you would expect from the organization that I think it's a positive step in the right direction.
Well, let's put it this way. There is no amount of money they could overpay Fred VanVleet that would be worse than their spending last summer, right? With Julius Randle, Taj Gibson, the 3 months or 4 months they got out of Marcus Morris and everything else, right? So by their own standard, even drastically overpaying Fred VanVleet would be a giant win compared to what they've usually done, because it's actually a position of need. You could talk yourself into him being a capable starter at that spot. He would give you numbers. He would be exciting. The team would still be completely dreadful, but there are a lot of yes. They could burn money in a lot of worse ways. All right, your second scenario, and I really like this one: Montrezl Harrell to the Detroit Pistons. So presumably, you know, Detroit clears out Andre Drummond, this guy who's not a modern center. They trade him for, you know, a bag of peanuts at the deadline of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And, you know, Detroit's got a hole at the five, right? So you're trying to plug it with a more modern solution, a guy who's probably outplayed his sixth man role and sixth man money with the LA Clippers. What other layers to this decision making do you see? Is it just a simple fact of the Clippers can't afford to keep everybody?
I think that that is a part here. It's more just like, in going through this exercise, I was looking at all the teams that would have a lot of cap space. A lot of the teams are really bad, including the Detroit Pistons. But this organization is kind of embarking on a soft rebuild. And what I mean by that is, you know, they could have moved Derrick Rose and Luke Kennard at the deadline, but they didn't because they want to be somewhat competitive next year. So they get out from Andre Drummond, they don't want to pay him. So that's just like the clear signal that, hey, we're not really trying to make the playoffs next season. That's not our objective. But at the same time, they don't want to be in the basement. So I think they're going to spend money this summer. And Montrezl Harrell just makes a lot of sense. I mean, he's got a very similar offensive game to Drummond, except he plays infinitely harder on every possession. And, you know, if you're a team that's not really trying to put 2 feet in the pool and rebuild with conviction, this is someone who's easy to root for. His offensive skill set just makes life easier for ball handlers. And he isn't, what I really like about it is he isn't too good so as to damage your standing in the lottery. He's just kind of a really solid piece who fits really well with what they have there. They can keep Christian Wood, who has a really low cap hold, and they can kind of start to build something logical around those two in the front court. And obviously Blake Griffin is still hanging around, and we don't know what his health will look like coming off of knee surgery. But I'm pretty confident that even those two, Blake and Montrez, could coexist. And I also don't think that Blake is long for Detroit, so I really wouldn't concern myself too much with that. But I just like the fit here.
Yeah, I think if you're Detroit, you can't be building this thing around Blake anymore, right? Like at some point, your hope within the next year or two is you could find some deal to kind of get off of him and you move forward. I mean, is it a little bit weird between those two players if Blake comes back healthy? Is your spacing cramped? Do you have enough like length and traditional shot blocking if you're playing both those guys heavy minutes together? Probably not. And then is Blake kind of versatile enough defensively at this stage of his career with the injury issues to sort of really make, you know, an ideal defensive system work? You know, maybe not. But I think if you are going to be committing a lot of money to Montrezl Harrell, you're sort of looking at him as your franchise level big for the next 3 or 4 years, right? Like, he's not going to be an all-star level player probably, but he's going to be your most reliable kind of foundational type big man. And if you're asking me who would I rather have, Andre Drummond or Montrezl Harrell for the next 4 years, or frankly, if you're asking me who would I rather have, Montrezl Harrell or Blake Griffin for the next 4 years, there's a really strong argument you'd rather have Harrell. I mean, he is very consistent. He brings great energy, like you mentioned. He is a pretty skilled scorer in the right situation as long as he has people setting him up. And I think defensively there's holes, but you know, he's able to contribute. I mean, he's not a, you know, a huge negative. Now, does he benefit and do his numbers benefit from playing with a lot of talented players, you know, in LA? I think there's an argument to be made there for sure. But he's also found success with lots of different types of teammates on the Clippers because they've turned their roster over here, you know, multiple times over the last couple seasons. So, you know, if I was a team with cap space this summer, Harrell would be one of my very top priorities. I think he's got a strong case to win Sixth Man of the Year this year. And I just think in general, he's one of the more underrated players in the league. So I like where your head was at on that one for sure. I do wonder, though, does Steve Ballmer have some scheme to kind of keep Harrell, right? Is there some way where they can keep him, or do they try to move in a different direction, keep Zubac as their starting center, and then maybe go cheaper or go smaller even, you know, with those backup minutes? That's a really tough decision and one that we'll just have to kind of see play out. All right, your third and final scenario here that I want to talk about, Michael. Paul Millsap to the Phoenix Suns. And, you know, I've been kind of harping on the idea that I thought Denver should have traded Millsap. He just sort of run his course from an age perspective in terms of kind of a big-time contributor. Now they're not even going to be able to benefit from having him during the playoffs potentially. So that winds up, you know, blowing up in their face a little bit, unfortunately. Why did you pencil in the Phoenix Suns here? Because if I'm understanding this correctly, doesn't DeAndre Ayton want to be a power forward? So even though he definitely should be a center, are we pushing DeAndre Ayton down to small forward in this scenario, Michael, or how are you accommodating for Paul Millsap?
Well, I know that the Phoenix Suns are your favorite team, Ben. So I thought this, I wrote this one specifically with you in mind.
Well, I appreciate that. You're just trolling me individually, just like you do on this podcast all the time. But continue.
I mean, everything we saw from Ayton over the past couple months before the season was postponed was with him at the five and a lot of success. You know, they had Kelly Oubre before he had surgery, Mikal Bridges, Ricky Rubio, Devin Booker. That lineup was extremely good. So Ayton just kind of looks like more and more as the season was going along and progressing, he looked more and more like a legitimate two-way center, which is a huge development for the Phoenix Suns. So I see that. I see Devin Booker, who has also developed. You know, he technically was an all-star this year, although he probably should have been one over Russell Westbrook anyway. And so you have this really intriguing young core that, in my opinion, should now be looking at, okay, what are we going to be, or how are we going to get to the next level, and what teams out there should we be modeling ourselves after? And, you know, they're not going to be the Los Angeles Lakers. They're not going to be the Los Angeles Clippers. That's just not the track that they're on. The track that they're on is what the Denver Nuggets were on a few years back when they signed Paul Millsap, and he helped elevate them to be a really competitive playoff caliber team. So you take, it's kind of the parallel here is Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray with Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton. And so...
Yeah, so I'm picturing here, Michael, is you have him, Paul Millsap, lined up as the driver's ed instructor, and he's had a lot of success in that role of, like, teaching guys kind of the right way to play, be professional on and off the court. Here's how you actually structure a competent defense and everything else. And I think most driver's ed instructors, if I remember correctly, usually they're guys in their 50s and guys in their 60s. Now, at some point, if the driver's ed instructor goes blind, he's not going to be a very good driver's ed instructor anymore, right? Now, all of a sudden, things are getting dicey. It's the blind leading the blind. You're getting into car accidents, and the insurance premiums are going way up. And even though you have the signs on your car that say ABC Driver's School, you know, everyone's just wondering why you're zigzagging all over the road. Is Paul Millsap into the blind driver's instructor phase of his career? In other words, does this idea sound better in theory than it would play out in practice because he just doesn't have that much left?
This is one of the best metaphors I've ever heard from you. I just got to say, that was beautiful.
Well, thank you. Look, this is honestly what I'm worried about. It's a little bit of the KG return to Minnesota. And I know you love KG, but I was one of the few people who was like, come on, are you really trying to do this? And you talk it up, oh, he's going to mentor Cat. It's going to work out so great. And oh,
but Ben, look how great Karl-Anthony Towns is on the defensive end.
That's what I'm saying.
All goes back to Kevin Garnett.
That's what I'm saying, Michael. You've brought so many stats to the table this year about how frustrated you are with Karl-Anthony Towns' development. And the narrative juice is so sweet. Oh, KG's going to mentor Cat and turn him into this all-time player, right? And this is obviously a lesser discussion because we're talking about Paul Millsap and DeAndre Ayton. I mean, come on. But you get what I'm saying. Like, is this idea better than how it could really play out?
I mean, at that point, just to continue the comparison, KG was just beyond washed up at that point in his career. Like, Paul Millsap is, he's still a very solid contributor, and there are some, like, you could totally make the case that he's been, when healthy, the second most consistent player on the Denver Nuggets, and the Denver Nuggets are, you know, I think they have the second or the third best record in the Western Conference right now. So he's still a very productive player. He's a defense first professional. He's selfless. And I do like what I like about the driver's ed instructor metaphor there is just like, yeah, you bring him in, he's not on the same timeline as Booker and Ayton, and that's fine. Like, this team needs to just get to the playoffs and learn what that experience is like. And then when Paul Millsap's contract comes off the books, like, we're not expecting a humongous long-term commitment here, but when that contract comes off the books, then you replace them. You're hopefully in a place where you can replace that production with a player who doesn't necessarily have to fill the off-court role or the locker room role as well. And Booker and Ayton and some other players in there can kind of pick up the void there. So that's kind of where my head's at with it. And I just think that the way that Millsap plays, how he doesn't need shots, he doesn't need touches, and he's just so good on the defensive end and so smart still. Like, his on-off numbers with Denver are just, they've been terrific ever since they signed him for a reason. And if he's able to, you know, give, you know, 85% of that to Phoenix, then that's just a coup for them.
I like what you're thinking. Look, I've defended Paul Millsap's honor for the better part of a decade. I'm just reaching the point where I'm ready to sell the stock. You know, the last couple of years, I think he had a big injury in 18, missed 12 games in 19. I think he missed something like 20 games in this year, 2020. That part has me nervous. I think he's about to turn 35. That part definitely has me nervous. And what really has me nervous more than anything is that Phoenix would just throw some crazy number at him that would just make me want to vomit, right? And it would be, to be able to convince him to go there, that premium that the Suns have to pay, usually when they try to get free agents or even, you know, sometimes trading for guys' contracts, it's always just revolting. And I'm just already preemptively nervous about how much it would cost for them to do that. And then what the expectations would look like for him going there. I think that he might just be better suited to taking a smaller contract on a team that's in position to be a contender already, and, you know, try to fit into a smaller role than what you're describing. Because I do think that Phoenix would need to lean on him fairly heavily, and I'm just not sure he's that guy anymore. All right, Michael, I loved all of those scenarios. People should go check out. You have additional scenarios on the SB Nation article, so check Michael out on Twitter at Michael V. Pina, and you can hop in and yell at him or agree with him on his matchmaking expertise. We had an interesting wrinkle to switch gears here. In a Rachel Nichols interview with Adam Silver last week, she asked him directly, what are you going to do about the NBA awards? And, you know, what happens with the awards show? If the season's delayed, how is this going to play out? You know, the season could be canceled. And Adam Silver said, look, I'm not there yet. I haven't made a decision. And that had me a little bit nervous, Michael. And I want to just state, like, very clearly, this is a very weird situation with the season being suspended. If it does wind up getting canceled, I think that there should be no debate here. The NBA needs to hand out awards, season-ending awards, for a couple of reasons. First of all, history matters. There's been an MVP every single year basically since the 50s. That streak should not stop just because we didn't get the final quarter of the season. You look at the lockout shortened seasons where there's 50 games or 66 games played. I think the average team has played 65 games this season. So to me, that's enough of a sample size. Yes, it's frustrating we didn't get to see LeBron and Giannis kind of go head-to-head down the stretch for that debate. And some of these other awards, you know, may or may not have been settled. but I think that there needs to be awards, in part because the collective bargaining agreement ties performance to compensation, right? So some guys are qualifying for Supermax deals because they win MVP or Defensive Player of the Year, or they get all NBA. You can't just not hand those out and therefore deny guys the opportunity to get those kinds of awards. So for me, there absolutely needs to be awards no matter what. Now, how does it actually play out is a very tricky question, right? Because if you're trying to salvage some part of the season and you do it in June, you can't do your normal voting in April, right? When it would normally happen, because there could be games to come. But if the NBA does decide to say, okay, we are canceling the rest of the regular season, then I think they should be ready to hold the awards voting basically as soon as possible, right? Now, this all leads to this idea, though, that usually they have this red carpet ceremony in Los Angeles at an airport hangar with, you know, hundreds of media members and hundreds of people in attendance, and the stars fly in from all around the country and everything else. That sounds like an event that would be completely against every CDC guideline that's out there, right, Michael? So there could be easily be a situation where even if they can salvage the playoffs and play them in empty arenas, they're actually not able to put on the awards show. So I'm going to ask you, from a brainstorming perspective, if you've put any thought into like what this awards process could look like or should look like. And I bring this up because we had a guy named Louie in the Philippines who writes, "I'm a longtime listener and I'm a new fan of Michael Pina and his smooth, sarcastic remarks. I'm currently stuck in a community quarantine and I had a lot of time to do some thinking. I usually listen to 12 podcasts, but now I'm down to 3 these days, and Open Floor is one of them. So I appreciate that, Louie." And his brainstorm, his quarantine brainstorm, included an idea for the award show. And he wanted Adam Silver to give a press conference or a speech. He wanted a lively in-studio guest performance with Dame Dalla, Damian Lillard, rapping in the background. He wanted Inside the NBA as the host. You know, maybe do it similar to like the All-Star Draft. And then he wanted speeches from people who did win the awards to come in by video call. And then he wanted live Twitter reactions, hopefully with NBA players encouraged to participate because they couldn't all come together in one spot. And then he was hoping that there would be donations from the NBA to the winners and like local organizations for where they play that are tied into coronavirus relief efforts. So this is a pretty well thought out idea by Louie in the Philippines. And he emailed us openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Michael, is there anything you would scratch from Louie's idea? Do you have a better idea? And how would you have these awards play out?
First of all, Louie, great email. I am honored that you are a fan of me and my smooth, sarcastic remarks. And honestly, like, this is so detailed and well thought out that I don't even know why I'm here right now. We should just be reading your emails on the air and letting people take them in.
Here's the
thing,
Michael.
Not to devalue myself real quick, but yeah, no, go ahead, Ben.
No, I'm the one having the existential crisis. Every time we get an email from one of these guys praising you lately, I feel like John Wall watching Bradley Beal 50-point efforts. Like, there goes my franchise, right? It's just being swooped out from right underneath me. Thanks a lot. But no, in all seriousness, just like John Wall, you know, I'm going to say the right thing. Michael, I'm a big fan of your smooth, sarcastic efforts as well. Thank you so much for everything you bring here. It's not a fight for control of the franchise in any way whatsoever. We're all on the same page. Everything is great. No, but in all seriousness, what do you think about the awards?
So, I mean, off the top, just I'm not a huge fan of the award show in general, so if it just didn't happen, that would be cool with me. But I do like some of the elements that Louie brings to the table here. And so I'm kind of coming a little bit out of left field with what I was thinking. And I incorporated a lot of what Louie said in his to my own idea, which is probably not practical in real life. But I'm just going to throw this out there. I don't know if you, Ben, or if any members of the Open Floor Globe were a part of or heard about Club Quarantine over the weekend. It was basically, for those who do not know, DJ D-Nice basically played a 9-hour set on Instagram Live from his living room. And it turned into this incredible, surreal social media experience where you had Will Smith, Rihanna, Michelle Obama, Oprah, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Dr. J. All these people were in the room watching and taking part, and they were in the comments. And it was just like, it was honestly just one of the most incredible things I've like ever been. I'm not going to say I was a part of it, but I did watch it.
Wait, so this is on Instagram Live, right?
Yes, it was incredible. And so
let me ask you, like, my invite must have got lost in the mail. How'd you get invited? I mean, what happened? Like, I know I understand when there's like parties at One Oak that I don't get into, fine, like I already understand that, but no one notified me of this party. Michael, am I just not cool enough? I wasn't on the list.
I don't mean to come here to hurt your feelings. It was an open public forum. I should have shot you a text. That was my fault, Ben.
Oh,
we'll so take care of it.
You were the bouncer. You kept me out because my pants weren't good enough?
Basically, and you wear glasses. That was basically the only other entry.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't mean
gosh.
To be mean, but that's what the deal was.
So you're just like, four eyes, you're out. 110,000 people, you can all stream with D-Nice, no problem. You can hang out with Obama.
So that's exactly what happened. So in trying to tie this into an NBA award show, I feel like the award show could possibly capture that same vibe. And what I'm imagining is, you know, Adam Silver just basically going to D-Nice's apartment with, I'm going to just say Charles Barkley, and we don't need the whole inside the NBA crew because we're all social distancing. But Barkley there because he's the most entertaining one, and he's our favorite, I think. And basically, you just turn the award show into club quarantine, and you have all the players in there, and they're commenting, and they're talking to each other in the chat, and, you know, DJ D-Nice is calling everybody out and hyping them up and taking song requests, and it's just this real, like, community vibe and a wonderful engagement opportunity for just everybody, and I'm sure there would be a ton of other celebrities in there, and we'd even let you be a part of it, Ben. And it would be cool. I mean, I don't really know how this all would work or anything like that, but just thinking off about it, this would be the most fun way to pull it off, I think.
I love how you're straight up treating me like the blind driver's ed instructor of this party. Like that's the level of respect that I get from you. It's crazy. No, I think you're on the right track. There's no question. I wrote about this a little bit in my newsletter as well this week for the Washington Post, but the NBA is trying to be the social media league forever, and it really is. And you're looking at all the NBA guys right now. What are they doing? They're all on Instagram Live all day long. So much so that I'm hearing complaints from media members being like, look, not everybody has to be on Instagram Live. Like, if you don't really have a great story to tell, don't just sit there and randomly broadcast from your living room. It's okay. Now, generally, I think, you know, all content is good content most of the time, but maybe we're hitting... maybe we're testing the limits of that adage, right? But if you organized it for the award show, so you did have a studio set up somewhere, you did have like Adam Silver with the nomination somewhere, and then you had the award winners on hand to sort of do live broadcasts, like kind of behind the scenes from their living room, I think that could honestly be better than the actual award show is. Like, I actually enjoy the award show more than most people because I get to go to it, and it's like, you know, it's a fun time, and I really enjoy the speeches and the post-game press conference and everything else. But if we took that away and instead, like, Giannis wins the MVP, and he's jumping around his living room with his little child giggling in the background, and then he just, like, gives us a little speech about, hey, you know, it's been tough these last couple months, but, you know, this means a lot to me, and, you know, he just does it with his camera phone. Like, that does bring the fans right to your player. And ultimately, that's like the NBA's whole hope, is this behind the scenes and an intimate experience. So I think it could work. You know, obviously, you'd be sacrificing something in terms of production quality. But I do think that you'd be meeting your fans where they are. Now, are they going to be able to get as many streamers as this rapper you're describing? Okay, that's an open question. Mm-hmm. But I think if you advertised it, if you had your television and media partners pushing it as well, if you made it available like on YouTube as well as television, as well as Instagram, you know, maybe a Twitter live video as well, you could get a lot of people watching and paying attention. I think it could still be salvaged and it could work. I just think it's really important, Michael, the NBA thinks long and hard about the awards, because Adam Silver spoke to Rachel Nichols about this idea of the psychic damage of not having sports, like what that's doing to Americans as a whole. And if they do have to cancel the season and it's done, it's going to hurt a lot of people, right? And we're all in denial. Oh, we're hoping that it doesn't come to that. We hope they can salvage something. But you look at these, whether it's the infection numbers, death toll, everything is increasing, you know, dramatically here from week to week. And it could easily get to a point where there's just like no turning back. And if it comes to that point, the awards are like the best weapon the NBA has to comfort its fans and to comfort its players in a time of what would be real distress, right? So to me, I really hope that the contingency plans are happening on the awards so that they would be able to be, you know, the voting would happen quickly and that they could do this type of, you know, social media type show pretty quickly after a potential cancellation, just in the event that it comes to that, so that not everybody's hearts are broken simultaneously. All right, Michael. On a lighter note, we got some just incredible questions from the Open Floor Globe this week. All over the world, people were checking in with great questions, just like Louis. Here's one from Canada. Steven writes, "Thanks for keeping the pod up with great content despite everything that's happening. Canada is pretty much in the same boat as the southern neighbors, but we're carrying on, and Open Floor is hands down the best NBA podcast." Good job, Steven. You knew I would read it if you sucked up to me. And he goes on to write, "On last week's podcast, Ben brought up the 1995 playoffs, and my ears perked up. I was 12 years old at the time, and that season in playoffs was such a pivotal moment for me as an NBA fan. It's also the reason why I became a graphic designer. The graphics at that time were just super dope. With the birth of the Raptors, basketball was much more accessible in Canada that year, and I watched more games than ever. And even though the Raptors have always been my favorite team, that duo of Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway was undeniably great, and it helped me understand the beauty of the game. Shaq's brute force and charismatic nature tearing down rims literally made me think he was a superhero. Penny quickly became my favorite player for his ability to score and assist with finesse. These dudes were bad men. I even remember sneaking into Blue Chips, the movie, just to see those guys on the big screen. I've never actually been a Magic fan, but I sure did love those years until Shaq broke my heart and left for LA. My question is, was this duo underrated? And do you have a particular basketball moment that changed the way you think of the world?" And he said, "Thanks also for bringing some much-needed nostalgia back during these trying times." And he agreed with me, like Michael, when I said last week that Jordan wearing 45 during that season was super weird. And he went on to say it was obviously the reason the Bulls were knocked out of the playoffs that year. So I'm not sure we're going to go to the numerology explanation on why Michael actually lost in the playoffs. But Michael, I'm curious, were you as big on Shaq and Penny as our guy Steven from Canada?
Well, first off, sneaking into Blue Chips is a great move that I can kind of relate to. I actually snuck into Kazam back in the day, which was Shaq's great movie about, I don't even remember, him being a genie, and I remember there were cheeseburgers that fell from the sky. Just Michael, a quality movie.
Didn't Kazam set the record for Academy Awards? I think it did. Like, it had, like, I think I want to say, like, 22 nominations and 7 wins, if I'm not mistaken. All-time records in both, but anyway, continue.
No, yeah, I think you're onto something there. I would say that, you know, if we're just saying Shaq and Penny, are they underrated? I think they're properly rated. I think back to the early 90s Magic 30 for 30 that came out a little while back, and, you know, they were getting compared to Durant and Westbrook and Harden and that era of the Oklahoma City Thunder, and that felt accurate to me. I mean, they were young, they were exciting, but at the end of the day, they did not accomplish what we thought they could. So in that form, they're kind of, like, their legacy is kind of just tragic, and that really sucks to say, but that's how they're remembered, and I think that's accurate. That's how they should be remembered.
They were capable of so much more, in part because Penny was capable of so much more. You know, injuries just kind of derailed his career later, and then, of course, the split. I think the split gets wound up being underrated because of Shaq's split with Kobe, right? So it's, like, not even Shaq's highest-profile divorce, which leaves Penny as, like, you know, his second ex-wife, which, okay, you know, tortured analogy there, but you sort of get where I'm going. Penny's real legacy to me has become the commercials, the Nike commercials, because those have held up so well. Tyra Banks in those commercials, formative experience for, you know, many viewers around the world.
There's don't need to get into this, but yes, I agree. Yes.
I wasn't going to get into it. I was going to just leave it there, Michael, but the groan in your voice was slightly creepy. It's a little borderline creepy. But But I think they're a little bit underrated here. But they didn't, like you're saying, they didn't really accomplish that much, so they're going to wound up getting lost to history slightly. One thing, though, I want to mention, one of my proudest moments of my life, Michael, and this is going back when I was probably in college, so right around the turn of the century, which, boy, that's such an old man thing to say. Maybe I am this driver's ed instructor, but right around 2000, Penny Hardaway was doing some event at Venice Beach in California, and I just happened to be there during the summer. I don't know exactly why, but he was walking away from the event, and I don't exactly know what I said, Michael, but I made some sort of a wisecrack. It might have even been a reference to the Penny Hardaway commercials, but my wisecrack made Penny Hardaway laugh. And to me, up into that point of my life, that was my greatest achievement. And I basically reminded my friends of that on almost a daily basis. And I would always have them vouch for me to other people. Hey guys, do you remember when I made Penny Hardaway laugh? And they're like, yeah, we do. it was like a little 3-second exchange as he was walking by and he was just being kind. But for, a solid 5 years there, Michael, that was the best thing I'd ever done.
No, that's incredible. And I mean, that should probably go, I'm not going to say that's the first line of your obituary, but that's got to fit there somewhere for sure.
It's way up on the list, Steven. I really hope I impressed you with that incredibly lame story. All right. Nathan checks in from Melbourne, Australia. He writes, hey lads, longtime listener, first time emailer. I'm really baked and I'm listening to a few missed shows on my new couch. Self-isolating best practices. Strange times we're in. And Michael, he goes on to just give us a nonsense email that really did not make any sense. Nathan, I understand what you're up to and how you're coping. I get it. No judgment there. But just try to be slightly more coherent with the rest of your email next time. Michael, we're just going to spin his question, which was sort of about going back in time to 1946 and going through every NBA finals to kind of put together a dream finals. Again, it wasn't coherent. It didn't make sense. But here's what I'm going to ask you, Michael, and I'm going to pretend this question came from Nathan, our baked friend in Melbourne. What was the one finals game that took place before you were born that you wish you could have attended and maybe even written about as a media member? Is there one? Is it your white whale game that you wished you could have a time machine and be 20, 30 years older so you could have gotten to experience? What is it, Michael?
So, first of all, our questions in this episode are just off the roof, through the charts, incredible. I want to say that, Nathan...
Wait, off the roof and through the charts. You're starting to sound like Michael Jordan right now, man. The ceiling is the roof, or is it is it through the roof and off the charts? What's happening, Michael? Are you making up new phrases, or am I just behind the times?
I'm feeling a lot of inspiration from Nathan and what's going on with him right now.
You got a contact high from Melbourne, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
All right, nobody do drugs out there. You're gonna throw off your favorite podcast host. They're not gonna be able to concentrate. Everybody live this drug free. Dare to keep kids off drugs. Anyway, Michael, continue.
No, but I really loved where you went and where you took this, which was, trying to find the white whale finals game before we were alive. And for me, it's pretty easy. Game four of the 1984 finals.
Wow.
This game, the two teams were the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics. The Celtics were trailing 2-1. They had just gotten blown out in game three. The series was looking very bleak. They were down 6 with about 7 minutes to go when Kevin McHale clotheslines Kurt Rambis, and just the whole spirit of the entire series, the energy just shifts towards the Celtics, and they eventually win it in 7 and push their undefeated finals record to 8-0 against the Los Angeles Lakers. So that game just is, growing up around Boston, you would see clips of that nonstop all the time. People would still be referencing it. It was like better than a Carlton Fisk home run. It was an incredibly meaningful play. So that's got to be the game for me. I would just have loved to be in the building for that and experience it firsthand.
Do you consider yourself bloodthirsty, Michael? In other words, are you wishing you had been there to watch Rambis collapse to the court, or is it more of just like the history aspect of that victory?
It's just, I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
I
mean, you do strike me as bloodthirsty, Michael, in your own just kind of quiet psychopath type of way, just maybe a little bit.
I'm not going to refute any of that, no.
Well, I'm going to stand up for the Lakers side of things on this one. I think that's a great pick. I'm not going to detract from it. I'm just going to go a different direction. The game that I've always wished I could have watched in person or covered or everything else, the one that I've always heard about for years, it's kind of a stereotypical pick or an easy pick probably, but it's Game 6 of the 1980 NBA Finals. Magic Johnson's sort of emergence as, you know, arguably like an all-time great in his rookie year. Of course, the story goes, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is hurt. He can't play in Game 6 against the Sixers. It's in Philadelphia. They're maybe going to save him for Game 7 if they need to. Magic Johnson, a rookie who's 20 years old, gets thrust into the role as a center in Kareem's place. Is he going to be able to save the day? What do you know he does by putting up 42 points, 15 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals, and a block in 47 minutes. He shot 14 of 23 from the field. Like, that stat line feels fake for any era, feels made up. The idea that you would do that in a closeout finals game as a rookie is just preposterous. And I went back through to see, has anyone else done this in the finals? Like, surely LeBron has put up a 42, 15, and 7, right? Never happened. No one else has ever matched that stat line in the NBA Finals. Mike didn't do it. LeBron didn't do it. No one else except for rookie year Magic Johnson. I'm sure the sports writers of their day were running that famous word, quote-unquote, unprecedented, into the ground after that game, right? Every single person is like, we've never seen this before. Like, what do we even compare it to? Do we induct Magic into the Hall of Fame as a 20-year-old? Of course, he had just come off the national title win the previous year with Michigan State. People were probably just freaking out at what the next 15 or 20 years of Magic's career might have looked like. And certainly, he delivered with crazy encore career, you know, leading Showtime for the next decade. But at that moment in 1980, it probably was just like mind blowing. And I wish I had been there to have my mind blown.
Can I just add real quickly that I actually watched highlights of that game over the weekend because they were airing, or maybe I just DVR'd it, the Basketball A Love Story, ESPN's 10-part, 20-hour documentary, which I just cannot recommend highly enough to anyone listening to this. You should go and watch that right now. I think it's streaming on ESPN's app. And they have highlights from that game, which I'd never actually, I mean, I obviously was aware of it, and I knew the box score line, and I knew the stakes and everything, but I'd never seen just a stream of clips and highlights from it. And, like, it is just magical and breathtaking, and it's like you're literally watching a legend be born before your eyes. I could not even imagine being there in real time to see that happen.
No, and it's crazy. The team he played against, by the way, had Maurice Cheeks, Dr. J,
yeah.
Daryl Dawkins, Lionel Hollins, Caldwell Jones, Bobby Jones, Henry Bibby, Steve Mix. I mean, that 8-man rotation is like names that most people would recognize 30 years later, right? And I guess now 40 years later. And for Magic to put the team without Kareem on his back and do it like that, it's just wild, man. And great plug there for Basketball Love Story. That's something that everyone should be turning to during this hiatus, no question about it. All right, Michael, we've got two more questions, and they're fairly serious that we're going to get to here. I want to make sure we hit this one. It's coming in from Fritz, and he's responding to my idea that I was kind of preaching, this idea of, look, like, this hiatus, this coronavirus is changing everybody's life, but do whatever you can to just adopt a, like, hey, you know, it's eventually going to be okay mentality, and, you know, push off your international trips or whatever else it might be into the future, and just try to, be as patient as possible. And Fritz makes a great point here. He writes, I totally understand that delay mentality is important, and it's true for most things, but I'm a high school senior, and the one thing I can't really delay is my senior spring. Instead, it's pretty much canceled, and it seems that summer may also be in doubt. This applies to all high school and college seniors, but for my friends and I, as athletes, we've all lost our senior nights, our last chance at championships, our last time playing on a team competitively with our friends, etc. I'm the captain of my high school sailing team, and we are losing our championship regattas. As a sailor, I'm lucky enough to be able to continue my sport in college next year at Connecticut College, but many of my friends who play basketball or baseball won't be able to play in college. So while it is important for everybody to stay inside and play their part, I think that it's important to recognize that some things can't be delayed, like senior years that have been stolen from us. And even our graduation now feels in threat. Other than SportsCenter's senior night segment, I feel like the loss of senior year for college and high school students across the country and world hasn't been discussed enough. Fritz, man, you are 100% right. There is no question about it. I want you to know, like, I focus a lot on this show in terms of my heart going out to guys like LeBron and Giannis and other big-time NBA competitors for them not getting the opportunity to sort of write the end of the NBA season. But my heart really, really goes out to college and high school athletes who are in your position, who are now not having the opportunity to compete for the titles that they were hoping for and not getting the closure to their academic or their athletic careers, and basically just have to move on to the next chapter without that knowledge. You know, frankly, and I'll say this straightforward, Fritz, it makes me sick to my stomach on your behalf, man. I really, really feel for you. And I'm sorry that that's happened. And there's no question it hasn't been discussed enough. You think about athletes like a Sabrina Ionescu at Oregon. Her college career is going to be ending, and she's potentially, you know, was going to be able to make history. And, you know, people are saying, hey, she has a chance to be one of the greatest women's basketball players of all time. To not get a tournament for her, you know, it's just after all the buildup and all the lead up to it, and man, it really, really gets to me. Michael, you know, save us here. What do you think? Do you hear what Fritz is saying?
Yeah, no, I totally sympathize as well. That's something that you can never get back. And you're just kind of a victim of really terrible timing. And unfortunately, like, life is about timing in so many different ways. And so it's a really terrible situation, and my heart goes out to Fritz and to the whole team. And just on a quick personal note, a close friend of mine went to Connecticut College, Fritz, and I visited him a few times, and he played Ultimate Frisbee. And so hung out with him there, and it's a very fun school, so at least you have that to look forward to, my friend.
Yeah, and Fritz, here's why I brought up your email, because I don't want this to just turn into a pity party, man. And I know it's going to sting you for weeks, if not months, if not years. Like, this feeling that the negative groove you might be in right now, that could linger, and it should linger. Like, let it linger. Don't rush through it. But the thing that I would encourage you to do, you know, is try to, you know, turn this challenge into an opportunity in any way you can, right? And right now you've got probably more time on your hand than you were expecting. You're not being able to practice. You're not able to go out on the boat maybe. You know, your life has been thrown upside down, and that's how it is for a lot of us out here, right? The toughest moments of my life personally have almost invariably led to some of the biggest breakthroughs, whether it's with my work or with my personal life or anything else. And I can go back 20 years and sort of give you different examples. I've never been through what you're going through right now in terms of having a season canceled, but I have been through some, you know, various, whether it's health scares or personal life changes, whatever it might be. And I think it's just a reminder, and this is something that you'll hear from basketball coaches at every level, how you respond to adversity, how you handle the toughest moments will define so much of your happiness and so much of your life course here going forward. So I'm just going to throw out a couple of brainstorm ideas for you, because you've got some time here and you are heading off to college. But, like, what can you use to kind of fill in this downtime? I mean, are you able to get onto a different type of workout routine than you were on before, where you're able to get yourself better prepared for that sailing challenge? Are you able to rework your diet in some way so you're going to be, you know, more valuable to your college team? Are you able to enhance a skill for your broader life, not even related to sports? Are you able to learn a language? You know, are you able to, you know, get tutoring on something like that, where you're able to give yourself a jump start and have a skill? You know, it's one thing if I could lecture my 19 or 20 year old self, I would say, man, really commit to the Spanish and maybe even consider Mandarin, right? Like, really, like, add this to your portfolio. It will make you a better person, a more valuable employee potentially, and it will open up other doors for you. Ask yourself those kinds of questions, Fritz, because I can promise you, like, we're not going to have a pandemic every single year, right? Like, this is a rare challenge, but it's also a rare opportunity. And you want to be able to tell the story of the end of your high school and have an upbeat to it. You don't want to be 40 years old looking back and saying, man, I was the best sailor in Connecticut and I never got to prove it. You don't want to have that be your story. You want your story to be, you know what? I had my senior season, sailing season robbed from me, but I spun it positively. I learned Spanish and now I'm the ambassador to Costa Rica, right? I mean, okay, maybe it's not going to play out exactly like that, but you get what I'm saying. How you respond to adversity is so important. And that's why NBA coaches, they'll come up with ideas of like next play mentality, right? Where if you commit a turnover, you pull a J.R. Smith and you have a blunder in a big moment, how do you rally yourself and get back on the right track? And you hear Steve Kerr talk about it all the time. Remember when he called his players last year during the playoffs bleeping giants? What he was referring to was not what they necessarily were dunking, shooting three-pointers, the physical attributes. Everything he was talking about with the bleeping giants comment was mentally, how they responded to adversity, how they were able to come together after injuries and go on to the, you know, into a road environment and dig out a really tough win against a quality team. It's always about that mental focus and the ability to see kind of the bigger picture. So Fritz, that's my challenge to you, man. I hear you loud and clear. I'm validating every negative feeling that you're having right now, but I also think you're going to be able to be the bigger person here and pull through the other side and hopefully add a skill or add an attribute or turn this negative into a positive in some way. And that's going to be the story of the end of your high school, not about, you know, oh, I didn't get to have a graduation ceremony or everything else. That's what I'm hoping for you. And, you know, that's from me to you, heart to heart. I know it's mushy. You know, you don't have to play it in front of your girlfriend, but nobody else is listening anyway, so don't worry about it.
Just control what you can control, man. That's and focus on what you can control, because if you get wrapped up in what you can't, you'll drive yourself insane.
Absolutely right. All right, our last question, Michael. It's a follow-up. Do you remember the Aaron Gordon Orlando Magic fan from a couple weeks ago who was seeking revenge because his girlfriend cheated on him during the slam dunk contest?
I will never forget it.
And we tried to give him some real, you know, serious life advice about not getting dragged down to her level and moving forward and not trying to seek revenge and certainly not hoping that Aaron Gordon would take HGH and cheat to his own benefit and therefore win an NBA title. I mean, you remember this whole conversation, right, Michael?
I think about it every day.
Well, we have bad news. Jonathan wrote back in, and his story has changed considerably, Michael. Here it comes. Dear Ben and Michael, 2 weeks ago, I wrote my very first email to the Open Floor podcast. As you might remember, it addressed the topic of cheating scandals. I highlighted the email by talking about my own personal cheating scandal that happened on the night Aaron Gordon got cheated out of the dunk contest. When I wrote to you, my world was in a much better place. Since writing that email, I have canceled my spring break trip. I have been told not to leave my apartment, and I have been let go from my job because of the coronavirus. This might come as a shock, but I am not here for your sympathy. Instead, I come for forgiveness. And he writes in bold, I have sinned. That morning, 2 weeks ago, when I wrote my first email to you, I was completely lying. I wanted to write a simple question about cheating scandals, but I got carried away. One lie led to another, and I ended up making a fool out of myself, all because I thought I was funny. To make matters worse, I don't even like Aaron Gordon and the Orlando Magic. I'm a Golden State Warriors fan, and I am too young to even remember a time before Steph Curry. I am not a spiritual or religious person, but ever since hearing both of you give me heartfelt, honest advice to my abusive lies, my spirit has been in torment. What has resulted is terrible karma, and the only person I can blame is myself. Ben, Michael, to say that you have helped me see God is an understatement. As my life spirals out of control, I ask for your forgiveness, your mercy, and your grace. Whatever you need from me, I am here. If my confession requires me watching 5 Magic games, that's fine. If it requires me watching 10 pre-Curry Warriors games, I understand. If forgiveness requires you to get creative with my confession deeds, I accept. The only thing I have right now is time. And he signs it Jonathan the Liar, Michael. So here's the deal, Jonathan. Here's the problem. You know, now that you've lied and abused our trust, I don't know how much of this email I can believe. And that really makes me sad to admit. I don't even know if you're really a Warriors fan. I don't know your age. I question this whole story, Michael, and I don't really know what my advice is for Jonathan. I'm not sure I can forgive him. I feel so betrayed here, Michael. Are you ready to forgive? And if so, what's Jonathan's penance?
I'm a merciful person, right? So I'm
willing you said merciful or merciless? Because I know you were talking about like Kurt Rambis bloodlust not too long ago. So you better clarify.
Kurt had it coming. I am merciful. I think that if Jonathan is coming clean here as the liar that he is, then we should forgive him. But I will say it is very difficult to have sympathy for someone who is a Golden State Warriors fan who is too young to remember a time without Steph Curry. That's just, to me, the this is a family pod, so I don't want to curse or anything, but that type of fandom, that fan category is just really tough to align myself with.
Michael, this is not his sin. His sin is making up his girlfriend cheating up on him, okay? Come on. Like, if he wants to bandwagon Steph Curry, that's fine. That's the least of our concerns.
But I will say, Jonathan, you should, I mean, like, watching 10 pre-Curry Warrior games as punishment, like, you should be doing that anyway. You're a Warriors fan. Watch that team suffer, learn about the organization's tough history, and become a real fan. That's all I have to say about that.
Look, Michael, I'm a reality-based person. You know, I honesty and integrity, that goes a long way in my book. But I think, Jonathan, you're being too hard on yourself, okay? Bottom line is, you provided us with an entertaining conversation, and not one, but two. And I'm not going to encourage all the other Open Floor Globe members out there to write in fake fan fiction emails about what their lives are like just solely so that we can give them advice on made-up scenarios for their own amusement. I'm certainly not going to do that, especially because the one guy we know who's done it, his life has spiraled out of control as he's described. So we don't want to set that precedent. We don't want to be jinxing people from continent to continent. But Jonathan, I forgive you. I've decided I can do it. I think your heart was in the right place. You were trying to contribute to the show in your own way. You know, I understand sometimes I get a little, you know, carried away with my comparisons and conversations. And, you know, certainly the John Wall analogy that I made earlier might have been going a little bit too far. Referring to Paul Millsap as the driver's ed instructor, you know, it might just be, you know, slightly over the line. You know, it happens. I forgive you. I say no penance whatsoever. But I do want, the only thing that I do want from you, Jonathan, I want real life updates from how you're going to put your life back together, okay? And first of all, I don't know if I can believe you that your life has fallen apart. So that stings, you know, that hurts, you know, a little bit. The trust has been violated. But if you have lost your job, if these other negative things have happened to you, I need some quarantine updates, okay? I don't need a diary. I don't need every single day. But as you pull things back together, I want you to keep us informed. I think that's your penance. Ultimately, you are now accountable to us. We own you, Jonathan, and I hope you don't forget it.
Speaking of fan fiction real quick, maybe, Jonathan, you could write a page or two about what the Warriors would look like if they traded Steph Curry instead of Monte Ellis to the Milwaukee Bucks. How about that? I think that's fair.
That's actually a great one. Good job, Michael. See, you are a benevolent god over here, the pod god. We see new layers to your personality every week. All right, guys. Jonathan, by the way, here's your real penance. Go to Apple Podcasts, search for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review, tap 5 stars, and tell the whole world how we've made your life better, okay? Please, Jonathan, that would really help us out. And then tell all your friends to give us a 5-star review as well. We would appreciate it. Guys, you can find Michael on Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. You can find me on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. We will be back later this week with a whole bunch of questions that we didn't get through today. Great questions, but keep them coming, guys. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. We'll take your serious questions, your lighthearted questions, your completely lying fan fiction. At this point, we're desperate. We'll take it all. We will, and we will discuss it all, Michael, in a couple days. Until then, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.